Hello and welcome to episode 5 of season 2 of Guido Talks. We'll be bringing you the top stories and a bit behind those stories of what's been appearing on the site this week. My name's Tom Harwood and today I'm joined by Christian Cowgill, reporter for Guido Forks and Guido Forks founder and editor Paul Staines. So without further ado, I suppose we should kick off with one of the biggest stories this week, and that is what's been happening north of the border in Scotland. After the R rate crept to the highest rate across the UK, the doubling time of the virus is now the worst in Scotland, worse than any other part of the UK. And so this new raft of measures have been imposed, these sort of big anti-booze measures, particularly across the central belt, but also this two-week very, very restrictive lockdown, closing pubs, closing indoor dining with alcohol, all of these things. And it was quite interesting because somehow the Guido Forks website was leaked the plans before anyone else. So we were able to get out these plans that we were fairly confident were true, because we got the leak actually from someone who had been right in the past about some other plans in Scotland. And so we put that up, lo and behold, 4 or 5 hours later, Nicola Sturgeon stands up in the Scottish Parliament to announce these restrictions. Although it's interesting, they're incredibly focused on alcohol. They're only going to last for 2 weeks, apart from in the central belt. So it'll be interesting to see how much they actually affect things, because of course the incubation period of the virus and the amount of time that it takes to translate cases into hospitalizations and deaths in some cases, is 2 weeks going to be long enough to keep those or to stop those from ticking up as well? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, well, I think that's... They're basing it on the 14-day lag, aren't they? So you can't tell if it's worked or not unless you do 2 weeks. I mean, I'm not an epidemiologist, by the way. So that's my assumption. Isn't that the logic of it?
Yes, but I mean, it's going to be a month until it affects deaths. So it's going to be a very strange situation whereby they'll lift all these restrictions as deaths are going up. So I don't know if they'll actually keep them on a bit longer than they're saying now, and what that's going to do to the freedom of the people of Scotland is quite sad.
Oh yeah, well, last of the lockdown was going to be 3 weeks, we ended up in 3 months, didn't we? So it's kind of, I think they're right to focus on the booze, because you do notice as the night goes on that people get a bit more touchy-feely, shall we say, you know, and less inhibited. I mean, that's always been the way I've used booze, is to reduce people's inhibitions, but that's probably my technique we shouldn't really go into.
So I don't know, because now that we've got table service at pubs and stuff, you're not going to be really sort of leaning across the table onto anyone else. I don't see how booze is actually that different. I mean, of course, it's very obvious how social distancing is impossible in a scene like a nightclub, which are sort of closed anyway. But where we're at table service, this was one of the restrictions that Sweden brought in successfully, actually, at the start of the pandemic. It's often sort of this myth that Sweden did nothing at all. But no, one of the things that they mandated was table service, and that seems to have worked quite well. So I'm not sure if actually booze is going to do all that much. And of course, it just seems like this is a win for the puritanical prohibitionists that have been pushing for minimum alcohol pricing and all that sort of thing in Scotland for many, many years now.
I wouldn't say I'm aligned with them, but I do like the table service. I feel it's one welcome development. I hope that lingers on after the coronavirus is long gone.
It's ruined the pub experience. I'm interested in the long-term effect on this. You know, we know how much of a personality cult around Nicola Sturgeon there is north of the border. And if banning booze, even that doesn't stop her popularity in Scotland, then, you know, we really are at North Korean levels of popularity up there.
It is interesting. Well, Professor John Curtis was on the PM programme on Radio 4 this week, sort of talking about how now we know that Scotland has potentially a worse outbreak of the virus than England, but also had harsher restrictions over the summer, and the difference in perception from the people of Scotland in terms of who's handled coronavirus well. It's extraordinary. I think Nicola Sturgeon has around a 70% approval rating in terms of how she's handled COVID. And objectively, by the data, you can see she's handled it worse than the rest of the UK. It's worse in Scotland than the rest of the UK. And yet she has a 70% approval rating. It's extraordinary.
Fur kilt, no knickers, so to speak.
I'd be careful about throwing around accusations at political leaders around the world. I think somehow, some degree it's to do with demography and cultural norms. You know, a lot of countries who have had, a lot of poor countries who have done nothing are having less cases than rich, well-developed countries with big public health systems, which is a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should dive too deep into the epidemiology of this, but I suppose that people in poor countries might have fewer underlying conditions, might have fewer old people because of the lack of the public health system in the first place. You know, there's a smaller vulnerable population for the virus to get because they have sadly passed away from other means. But perhaps we should move away from being armchair epidemiologists and towards something that we probably have a little bit more expertise in, and that is the machinations of Downing Street. Paul, what was the big announcement from them this week?
Ah, well, the big announcement is, of course, we for years campaigned to have televised briefings for Downing Street, White House style, so that readers and voters can see the news being made and demystify the lobby's Downing Street sources, which is usually a load of people in a sweaty room asking the spokesman the same question in different ways. So to our surprise, our pleasant surprise, after 10 years, Downing Street told us we've got our way and we are going to have them starting very soon televised press briefings. I think the reason Downing Street's changed its mind on this was the coronavirus briefings. They realised that actually they could get their message out direct. And also, as it turned out, I was right. When people saw how the lobby asks its questions and how they preen and go about trying to get extract information, the lobby's methods will be seen for what they are and people will have a lower opinion of them and the government might get a chance of putting its message directly. Now, Allegra Stratton is an experienced journalist. She's worked for The Guardian for a long time. She switched to TV. She did BBC Newsnight. She did ITV News. And last of all, Peston, before she went to work for Rishi Sunak. She was always the favourite. I mean, she has... there was an idea that they wanted a woman to present it in this day and age. Everyone, all the best jobs seem to go to women. The background she had for TV and the fact that she'd done an absolutely fantastic job for Rishi in holding, creating his profile and spinning on his behalf. I mean, a few weeks ago, we ran a small story about Rishi Sunak delivering a piece to camera sat on a private jet. It actually wasn't a private jet. It was one of those RAF BA-146s. And Allegra was on the phone to me, you know, because she was worried that it was going to be perceived as he would be perceived as, you know, a rich guy in his private jet. and we won't go into those rumours about him and a helicopter from constituency to Westminster plan. You know, he was going to go to Westminster. I mean, I'm sure they're not true. She was very forceful. She was demanding her to take it down. I know her a little from back in the day. And we came to a compromise where we would explain correctly that it was an RAF plane, not his personal private jet. and I joked to her that I'll see her when she settles into her new job, because she was always the favourite for this job. And she didn't say, I don't know what you're talking about, or didn't deny it or anything. She just, I think she hadn't actually made up her mind. And this was a few weeks ago. I think she knew... This is going to be a very, very tough job. It's going to eat you up. You know, if it's going to be... But she will have the advantage that she'll have to be in the room. You know, she can't answer the questions if she doesn't know the background discussions. So she's going to be close to the Prime Minister quite a lot, I think. And she will be, as they say, as I think in Hamilton, I no doubt Tom will sing out the very bits. She will be in the room where the decisions are being made. And that's very alluring. So good luck, Allegra. You've got a tough job. But if anyone can do it, she will keep the lobby, you know, in check.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from the very start of this process, everyone was assuming it would be Allegra, and it was a little bit strange as to why it's taken this long for that decision to be made. It seems that
you had to turn it down first, didn't you?
yes, no, definitely. That's exactly what I don't know. So I was talking to some of the people at the top of Downing Street a few weeks ago, and I was asking them about, you know, what's going on with the process. I mean, have they got a shortlist or whatever? And I was told there was a shortlist of 5, and we ran that on the site a couple of weeks ago. And also, I was told that they've started building the room, building the set for this. So I'm very excited to see what it's going to look like, how similar it is.
Was that set that we saw the CMO, you know, Witty and Valance at? Was that not the set? I think
we understand that it's going to be in the original lobby briefing room, which is in number 9 Downing Street, and it's quite an odd setup because it's actually an old courtroom that used to be used. And so it's got a lot of odd, you know, benches facing across from each other, and so it needs properly decking out. I also seem to remember back when I used to go in, there's a hell of a lot of building work going on just outside the window. So hopefully that will come to an end. And we talk about how this will expose some of the more dastardly tactics of the lobby. The thing I was always amazed at during the coronavirus TV briefings was actually they didn't do half of their usual rubbish. And even so, they were incredibly unpopular. You can't get across the sort of petulant, childish nonsense that they used to try and get the Prime Minister's spokesperson, James Slack, to back into the corner of a room. I can't remember at one point they were essentially spent an hour repeatedly asking whether the Prime Minister believes in basic human rights.
Well, let's hope they don't live stream on a Friday and test the alarms when they're doing the briefings.
It was just a test.
Amazing. Apologies for that interruption, but it does speak to the problems, I suppose, of doing any sort of live broadcast, especially in a building that's not designed for it. Number 9 Downing Street is not particularly designed for live television broadcasts. So I'm interested to see how they'll mock up the room, how similar it will be to the White House press briefing room, which I believe is a sort of more purpose-built facility than just a room in an old townhouse in a Georgian street.
Something I want to know is, who is her substitute? I mean, she can't work every day, so surely she will some days presumably get flu, hopefully only flu, or something like that, and who will fill in? I can't see Lee Kane volunteering to get in the front line. I actually bet 500 quid he wouldn't be the spokesman, so that was the easiest money I ever made.
Oh no, that wasn't the easiest money you made, Paul, because I saw you bet Top 3 times against me.
I just didn't like the fact that you were like only the 10th last candidate. You know, I wanted to get you down into the 20s.
My problem, I was going to do the same, but I genuinely did not trust Tom to screw me out of a lot of money.
Yeah, this is how you know it's not insider trading. Just the lack of trust between the Guido Fawkes team. Right, well, we should probably move on from that and go to Calgi. What was your favourite story this week?
Yeah, I'm gonna lump a couple together because we've had a couple of wonderful loony left Corbynista stories this week. The first one, which did amazingly well on the website, was Claudia Webb, former Labour MP, now independent after her expulsion last week. But she was in a select committee, the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and essentially asked Dominic Raab whether Britain was...
Sorry, Calgi, has she been expelled? I think she was just knocked off the front bench, wasn't she?
No, she's been suspended. Suspended.
Claudia Webb has been suspended over abuse claims.
I stand correct.
Now going to court, so it's a fun subplot. But yeah, she essentially asked whether Britain was as bad as Iran in terms of, supplying arms abroad and destabilising and you know, Dominic Raab basically said she had to, she better take a long, hard look in the mirror if she thinks that Britain is funding sort of private militias and funding terrorism in that way.
Well, she hasn't backed down. She doubled down.
She doubled down on Twitter.
She tweeted at me after the story. She tweeted at the Guido Fawkes Twitter that, you know, Britain was arming the Saudis who were killing Yemeni citizens, civilians. So she's sticking to her guns.
It's
sticking to her guns over that. I mean, blimey. This is a state that literally sponsors terrorism. That had the worst terrorist in the world until just last year when he was airstriked by the Trump administration.
It's just, it always amazes me how the Corbynista left can be so consistently, not just wrong, but downright offensive on foreign policy issues. Their tendency to always side with Britain's enemies or always give the benefit of the doubt to rogue states like Russia, Iran, Venezuela. It's just incredible. Their consistency, it was almost applaudable. But then we also had Zara Sultana, another fan favourite, you know, baby Corbynista, who put on a job advert for a part-time caseworker. And we did the maths, and she was only going to be paying this caseworker about 11 quid an hour. And actually, last year, she was supporting McDonald's strikers in their desire to get £15 an hour. And we asked the question, why did she support that when she's willing to pay her own staff a third less than what she's publicly campaigning for? And I don't think she's addressed that in the same way Claudia Webber has doubled down on Twitter.
She accused McDonald's of paying poverty wages, didn't she? But then she offered them less.
Yeah.
Her
tweet said something like, McDonald's workers on less than £15 an hour have to choose between heating and eating, and it's poverty pay and whatever. And then she pays her own staff less than that. It's extraordinary.
Don't McDonald's staff get a free lunch?
Now, one of the stories that we did this week that got the most pickup elsewhere and was subsequently run by a whole bunch of other news outlets and commented upon by actually Welsh Labour and the SNP being particularly irate about it, was a leak that we published of internal Brexit planning documents that the Cabinet Office had been drawing up that had a number of interesting warnings on some of the pages. And we flagged up two of them on the website, which said, make sure you don't share this information with the devolved assemblies. You know, keep this top secret. Do not tell the Scottish government, the Welsh government, the Northern Irish Assembly what is going on. And obviously this was very annoying for the SNP and for Welsh Labour, but also very annoying for the Cabinet Office, who were really not happy that we had leaked this this document. And I had some angry texts that evening. But it's really obvious as to why it says that, right? I mean, why would you share your sort of negotiation or preparation plans with, let's face it, hostile actors domestically? There's no way that the SNP would use this information in good faith to prepare or plan. They'd use it to score political points. So it's really obvious as to why the government did it, although they can't say that. So this really caused a lot of mischief all around, really.
It's very obvious, but at the same time, very fun to cause a bit of consternation. And it was, when I read that, I thought it would rile up all the right people, and it did, and it got us a good few headlines, and that's what makes
judging by the inbox, a good few of our readers felt it was an undesirable story. They didn't want to, I mean, it's news. We can't suppress it. It's the fact that it was unhelpful to the government. I'm afraid people don't understand what we're about. We're about news, not helping the government get through the day.
It's very rare that we're accused of sabotaging Brexit. but
or being on the side of the SNP.
Being on the side.
I don't know, Paul. Your SNP braces today may make may sway your allegiances.
Gilets jaunes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do share one sympathy with one main policy from the SNP, which is, I think, a free and independent Scotland would be good for Scotland and good for England. But we'll move on because Tom will blow his top.
I'm about to explode. So no, let's move on. And Calgi, what else did you like this week?
There's a couple of very internal House of Commons things which I'm always very interested in. We've got the fallout from the Margaret Ferrier incident, or Margaret COVID, as Nicola Sturgeon has resorted to branding her during the press conferences. And that is because of a rising number of cases. A couple of MPs are now having to self-isolate. There are more cases of COVID. There's been a big new push to enforce coronavirus in Parliament. You're having to wear face masks, although I can reveal that when I went in for lunch the day after this edict was issued, almost no one was wearing face masks, almost no MPs were wearing face masks. So if you want another one rule for them, one rule for us angle, that's a very easy one. There's also these new Perspex screens being put in the Commons. And another change the Commons is going to see, which isn't actually necessarily to do with COVID, but we also revealed that the new voting method that has come about due to COVID, where MPs tap in with voting cards rather than it being physically done by a clerk in the voting lobbies, that's going to stay forever now. So a bit of modernisation will hang about as a result of the changes seen around the COVID pandemic.
Mm. I mean, there was a little bit of modernisation in around 2014 or 15, where I think the clerks at the end of the voting lobbies stopped writing down names and started using iPads. So this is, I suppose, it's a gradual continuity where we're going from handwritten names to iPads to contactless.
To someone who is still angry that John Bercow removed the requirement for clerks of the House to wear wigs. Mm. So I'm not necessarily happy about the change. I think it's pandering to modern sensibilities, but what can we do?
Well, it's interesting because on the evening, or it was Tuesday evening when Lindsay Hoyle sent that message to all MPs, I think we were the first to get it up on the site quite quickly after it was sent out, that there would be a more enforcement of masks, that these Perspex screens would be going up, that they're really cracking down. The next day, not to be outdone, the Speaker of the House of Lords, the Lord Speaker of the House of Lords, Norman Fowler, started tweeting pictures of him wearing a mask and asking his noble colleagues to follow suit. So perhaps there's a little bit of rivalry there between the two speakers of either house.
Yeah, so they're going to try and...
Norman Fowler, who's in his 70s, isn't he? I thought he was still self-isolating. So I was quite impressed to see him actually in Parliament.
Well, he was he was down in the Isle of Wight for most of the pandemic and sort of trying to chair stuff by Zoom, but sort of basically decided that was impossible. And so when everyone sort of returned to work, he has now been every day sitting on the woolsack in the House of Lords managing stuff. But obviously, as an elderly and vulnerable person to this disease, he's very keen to make sure that everyone in Parliament follows the rules.
Don't blame him. Look what I'm doing.
No. Oh, wow. You do look like...
The caption contest is right there, ladies and gentlemen.
Amazing. Paul, you look like one of these... For the advantage of people who are listening on the podcast rather than watching, I'm going to attempt to describe what Paul is wearing. And I can only describe it as sort of like a glasses set that has something that looks a bit like a spade hanging down from it over Paul's mouth and nose. If you imagine sort of a stripped back witch doctor from the sort of 1600s, one of these plague doctors with beaks. It's like he's got a beak that's sort of hanging over his nose and mouth that's attached to a glasses Hannibal frame.
Lecter, if Hannibal Lecter brought out a range of GIMP masks, I think we're essentially somewhere between those.
The Hannibal Lecter comment is the one I've heard the most, but it goes down. I tell you, no one sits next to you on the airplane, so Aer Lingus don't have to worry about me giving it or catching it really well.
Of course, if anyone's seen the introduction scene to one of the new Bane films, one of the new like Batman Bane films, Bane obviously is the villain who wears a mask that looks a little bit like what you were just wearing there, Paul. And the opening scene is where he sort of hijacks an aeroplane and tears it in two. So I can understand why people would be a bit wary sitting next to someone in quite such an auspicious mask on an aeroplane.
Do you know what? Do you know, it does look a bit daunting, but actually it's not tight against your face, and when I get back into wherever, I just put it under soapy water and clean it, and it looks bad, but it's actually very comfortable.
Fair.
Anyway,
well,
sorry.
Well, no, it's
sounds like most of my wardrobe, Tom. Paul.
I mean, we're always accused by people who write into the site about being sort of COVID bedwetters over masks. But I mean, to be honest, like if we're going to look at all of the different things, I think as a team, we're pretty opposed to the curfew. We're pretty supportive of masks. There are measures that we can support, I think, in this country that are very low cost. And help keep stuff open. And then there are measures that are very high cost and questionable that I think it's right to question and oppose.
I don't think they're a great loss of my liberty to put them on. I mean, it's just, and I'm pretty certain that it stops your sneeze going on someone else. I'm not convinced that it actually protects you unless you've got a medical quality one. You know, the virus, I think, can get through. And there's some speculation that people are catching the virus in aerosol form via their eyes.
The other thing is that apparently sort of the virulency of the virus is less if it comes through a mask. Sort of the fewer droplets you get, the less bad a case you're likely to catch. But as our Zoom conversation is ticking down to its 40-minute limit, I think we might have to just leave it there. Top quality, no expense spared, as always on Guido Talks. Thank you for watching.
Cheers.